Hot. JVM right here, side one, for the record, program number 811, Walking the Snake in Ukraine, part four, being recorded on September 21st of the year 2014. Again, we have recently had another anniversary of the September 11th attacks, and one of the things that is so sad about having not properly investigated those is that we are continuing with the policy of supporting jihadist elements as proxy warriors in other parts of the world. We did it against the USSR in Afghanistan, wound up fighting against those forces after September 11th. We did it in the Balkans. We're doing it in the Caucasus, and we're also doing it against China. And the recent growing involvement against ISIS appears to an extent to be part of the blowback from failing to investigate the use of those Islamist elements as proxy warriors, particularly in areas that have fossil fuel deposits. We're going to look at an excerpt from For the Record. We're going to have an excerpt from For the Record 710, taking a look at the backing for jihadists in the Caucasus.
As a stark illustration of the binary functions of the Muslim Brotherhood vis-a-vis American power structure, consider the following from Julia Gorin from the Jihad Watch website. More details on the Georgia-hosted Jihadi conference emerge. An analysis published Monday by Defense and Foreign Affairs offers some corroboration for the Georgia-hosted, U.S.-approved Jihadi confab in December, the mention of which seemed to upset some readers. Here are the relevant excerpts from the 16-page analysis, which is subscription only and therefore not linkable. Meanwhile, Georgia is actively seeking to exploit the spread of Jamaat, jihadist mini-societies in the North Caucasus, in order to go after the Russian pipelines in hope of ensnaring the U.S. into actively supporting a new confrontation with Russia. In early December of 2009, Tbilisi organized a high-level meeting of jihadist groups from the Middle East and Western Europe in order, quote, to coordinate activities on Russia's southern flank, unquote. The Georgian embassy in Kuwait, for example, arranged for travel documents for jihadists from Jordan, Saudi Arabia, and the Gulf states. There is a large and very active Chechen and Circassian community in Jordan dating to the 19th century that is heavily represented in the intelligence services and the military. In Tbilisi, Deputy Minister of Internal Affairs Laura Kabatnadze was the host and coordinator. The meeting was attended by several Georgian senior officials who stressed that President Saakashvili himself knew of and approved of the undertaking. The meeting addressed the launch of both military operations in southern Russia and ideological warfare. One of the first results of the meeting was the launch soon afterwards of the Russian-language TV station First Caucasian. The jihadists of the North Caucasus, including the Arab commanders in their midst, came out of the early December 2009 meeting convinced that Tbilisi is most interested in the spread of terrorism. The meeting was attended by, among others, Mohammed Shaban, an Egyptian senior commander who is also known as Saif al-Islam and who has been involved in Caucasus affairs since 1992. He took copious notes. According to Shaban's notes, the Georgian government wants the jihadists to conduct, quote, acts of sabotage to blow up railway tracks, electricity lines, and energy pipelines in southern Russia in order to divert construction back to Georgian territory. Parenthetically, it would appear that some of the jihadist elements took blowing up railway tracks to apply to the Moscow subway, and the outrage at those acts on the part of the Russian people and Russian power structure should not be underestimated, and it is just mind-blowing at one level and truly outrageous that those Muslim Brotherhood / fascist affiliated elements of our State Department appear to be giving the wink and the nod to the Georgians. One wonders whether perhaps there will be some sort of retaliation, perhaps Russian mob elements or Russian fascist elements, and there is a growing fascist presence in Russia, will take the insult and the shedding of innocent Russian blood to heart, and just might see to it that some of these Muslim Brotherhood elements wind up doing something in retaliation against the United States, which the underground Reich, the element that controls these State Department and reactionary elements, would then say, look at Obama, he can't control terrorism, therefore we need to bring back you-know-who. And you-know-who and you-know-what will be back in short order, despite the fact that after what George W. Bush and his associates did, and they pretty much destroyed what was left of the United States, ruining the economy, doing untold damage to the military and national security establishment, destroying America's image and diplomatic stance abroad, and pretty much corrupting everything they could get their filthy little hands on, and they had their filthy little hands on an awful lot in 8 years, you would think that there would be no way they could even think about returning to power, but they're good at ruining things, and they're good at stirring up trouble, and it's one of the reasons I'm reading this article. Continuing with the article presented here, The Post, by Julia Gorin, this again from the Defense and Foreign Affairs publication, continuing about this Georgia-sponsored jihadist conference. Georgian intelligence promised to facilitate the arrival in the Caucasus of numerous senior jihadists by providing Georgian passports and to provide logistical support, including the reopening of bases in northern Georgia. Russian intelligence was not oblivious of the meeting, however. Saif al-Islam and two senior aides were assassinated on February 4th of 2010. The Russians retrieved a lot of documents in the process. Moscow signaled its displeasure shortly afterwards when the presidents of Russia and Abkhazia signed a 50-year agreement on a Russian military base in order to, quote, protect Abkhazia's sovereignty and security, including against international terrorist groups, unquote. A major issue still to be resolved is the extent of the U.S. culpability. Well, I suspect that John Loftus' analysis of the binary intelligence system and of the Obama administration as the last victim of World War II is to be taken very seriously here. I would note that as I noted in For the Record 642, I may have the number slightly wrong from off the top of my head, maybe 643, but the Bush administration in the waning days of its existence, no, it was after that actually, I think it was in the 650s, but the Bush administration in its waning days worked out a defense agreement with Georgia. Continuing with Julia Gorin's analysis. A major issue still to be resolved is the extent of the U.S. culpability. The same analysis recalls when this misguided approach was used in the Balkans and outlines how, in order to not alienate Muslims while we tried to contain terror from the Middle East, we fortified terror in the Balkans and jump-started the global jihad. Initially, the U.S.-led Western intervention in the former Yugoslavia was aimed first and foremost to salvage NATO, and with it, U.S. dominance over post-Cold War Western Europe from irrelevance and collapse. As well, the support for the Muslims of Bosnia became the counterbalance of the U.S. confrontation with jihadism in the Middle East. Anthony Lake, U.S. President Bill Clinton's National Security Advisor, formulated the logic for the U.S.-led intervention on behalf of the Muslims. The U.S. national interest, quote, requires our working to contain Muslim extremism, and we have to find a way of being firm in our opposition to Muslim extremism while making it clear we're not opposed to Islam. If we are seen as anti-Muslim, it's harder for us to contain Muslim extremism. And if we stand by while Muslims are killed and raped in Bosnia, it makes it harder to continue our policy, Lake argued. That, in the process, the U.S. would end up partnering with, supporting, and arming the very same jihadist forces Clinton was seeking to contain meant nothing to Washington. The only thing Washington cared about was the image of a U.S. rallying to the rescue of a Muslim cause. Note that in the 1990s, the U.S., like Britain, permitted and facilitated terrorist networks to operate in Bosnia and Kosovo for the purpose of Serb killing, and, along with Germany, we trained Albanian and Middle Eastern terrorists in Albania. Sure enough, The same decade saw U.S. officials participating in a December 1999 meeting in Azerbaijan, very similar to the December 2009 meeting in Tbilisi, where, quote, programs for the training and equipping of Mujahideen from the Caucasus, Central and South Asia, and the Arab world were discussed and agreed upon, unquote. The mention of this meeting comes in as the analysis gives background on how we decided to support terrorism against Russia. By 1999, the U.S. had given up on reconciling Azerbaijan and Armenia in order to construct pipelines to Turkey, and instead Washington started focusing on building pipelines via Georgia. For such a project to be economically viable, the Russian pipelines would have to be shut down. Hence, in early October of 1999, senior officials of U.S. oil companies and U.S. officials offered representatives of Russian oligarchs, unquote, in Europe, huge dividends from the proposed Baku-Ceyhan pipeline if the oligarchs convinced Moscow to withdraw from the Caucasus, permit the establishment of an Islamic State, and close down the Baku-Novorossiysk oil pipeline. Consequently, there would be no competition to the Baku-Ceyhan pipeline. The oligarchs, unquote, were convinced that the highest levels of the Clinton White House endorsed this initiative. The meeting failed because the Russians would hear nothing of the U.S. proposal. Consequently, the U.S. determined to deprive Russia of an alternate pipeline route by supporting a spiraling violence and terrorism in Chechnya. The Clinton White House sought to actively involve the U.S. in yet another anti-Russian jihad, as if reliving the good old days of Afghanistan, Bosnia-Herzegovina, and Kosovo, seeking to support and empower the most virulent anti-Western Islamist forces in yet another strategic region. By the way, as far as the good old days of Afghanistan, the landmark text, Invisible History, by Elizabeth Gould and Paul Fitzgerald would serve as a very, very good primer in that regard. I did four different interviews with those authors. Continuing, in mid-December of 1999, U.S. officials participated in a formal meeting in Azerbaijan in which specific programs for the training and equipping of Mujahideen from the Caucasus, Central and South Asia, and the Arab world were discussed and agreed upon. The meeting led to Washington's tacit encouragement of both Muslim allies, mainly the intelligence services of Turkey, Jordan, and Saudi Arabia, and U.S. private security companies, unquote, of the type that did Washington's dirty job in the Balkans while skirting and violating the international embargo the U.S. formally supported to assist the Chechens and their Islamist allies to surge in the spring of 2000. Citing security concerns vis-a-vis Armenia and Russia, Azerbaijan adamantly refused to permit training camps on its soil. Now, just to keep our, including my, head straight, let's remind ourselves that this exercise that Robert Spencer was good enough to let me engage in on these pages was not a defense of Russia. It was not meant to start an argument about how bad or how not that bad Russia is. The point is that foreign relations in a mad world require finding enough common ground with not-so-great states so that we can work together where we can work together. It is to minimize the messiness of things. Why, when we had Russia in its historically most malleable form, did we insist on provoking and provoking and provoking? Why did we make a bad situation like Russia worse when we had an opportunity to make it better? As with all problematic countries that we nonetheless find areas of cooperation with, we narrowed even those areas by dealing with the Russians in the bad faith that had been their trademark. Simultaneously, we moved away from picking the lesser evil in a given conflict and started siding with the greater. Well, I would suggest that the real guiding hand here is what is the Obama administration, notwithstanding, still in charge of the United States and much of the rest of the world, and that is what I call the Underground Reich, literally a Third Reich that went underground and that will ultimately benefit from pitting the U.S. and Russia off against one another. And then who will be the last man or the last entity standing? Well, that will be the Underground Reich, which will bring those surviving elements into a state of subservience.
That, again, from For the Record program number 710. The article was from Julia Gorin. Gorin, more details on the Georgia-hosted Jihadi conference emerge from Jihad Watch of April 12th of 2010. There was an interesting op-ed piece in the New York Times, part of the growing Cold War redux propaganda. This was called Russia's Next Land Grab by Brenda Schaefer, S-H-A-F-F-E-R, from the New York Times of September 9th of 2014. What was not mentioned was that this woman was a former advisor for the Azerbaijani State Oil Company, and then the sort of banging the war drums and the propaganda gongs about Russia's next land grab, which is what the title is. They're talking about Russian action in former Soviet republics in Asia and the Caucasus. Skipping down. Three times in the 1990s, Armenia and Azerbaijan signed peace agreements, but Russia found ways to derail Armenia's participation. In 1999, for example, a disgruntled journalist suspected of having been aided by Moscow assassinated Armenia's prime minister, speaker of parliament, and other government officials. We covered that assassination in For the Record 182 from November of 1999, and the assassins appear to have come from the opposite side of the political spectrum. They were Dashnaks, Armenian nationalists and fascists, who have been collaborating with the Third Reich and other fascist elements since the early 1930s. So again, this appears to be the complete reversal of facts that Adolf Hitler spoke about, because the verifiable elements who killed the Armenian political leadership in 1999 come from the Dashnaks. This is an excerpt from For the Record program number 182 from November of 1999.
There was an account of this on the San Jose Mercury News of Thursday, October 28th of 1999. This is a story by Dave Montgomery, Daniel Snyder, and Christopher Marcus, M-A-R-Q-U-I-S, at Dateline Moscow, a Mercury News Washington, a Mercury News Moscow Bureau story. It's headlined, Gunmen Execute Armenian Leaders in Bloody Siege. And skipping down in the story, we read of a recent attempt by U.S. Deputy Secretary of State Strobe Talbot to mediate a peace between, or a settlement between Armenia and Azerbaijan, another former Soviet republic that's been at loggerheads, very bloody loggerheads, with Armenia. We read, hours before the gunmen attacked, Kocharyan and the slain prime minister had met with U.S. Deputy Secretary of State Strobe Talbot for several hours about prospects for a peace pact with neighboring Azerbaijan, State Department spokesman James Rubin said. Initial speculation was that the attack was intended to derail peace talks between those countries to resolve the status of Nagorno-Karabakh, an ethnic Armenian enclave within Azerbaijan. The fierce conflict between the two former republics of the Soviet Union has resulted in 30,000 deaths and created an estimated 1 million refugees. The two sides have chafed under an uneasy ceasefire for more than 5 years, with Armenian forces controlling not only Karabakh but a significant swath of Azeri territory around it. Secretary of State Madeleine Albright arranged in April for the two nations' presidents to meet. Kocharyan and Azerbaijani President Haydar Aliyev held a series of meetings, most recently on October 11th on the border between the two countries, trying to reach a settlement. Albright dispatched Talbot to assess the progress of the October 11th meeting. Quote, they're closer to a deal than they've been since the 1994 ceasefire, unquote, said Coit Blacker, deputy director of Stanford University's Institute for International Studies and a former Clinton administration national security advisor dealing with the former Soviet Union. According to Blacker, the Clinton administration was hoping to wrap up a final peace agreement to be signed November 18th at a European Security Summit meeting in Istanbul. Talbot, who landed safely in the Turkish capital as the drama unfolded, initially reported that his meetings had been, quote, very productive, unquote, Rubin said. Rubin said there was, quote, no reason to think this is in any way related to Talbot's visit, unquote. By the way, I disagree with that. I would not rule out that possibility. I'm not saying that's necessarily the case, but I think this is an assessment which is frankly premature. By the way, the Prime Minister's name was Vazgen Sarkisian. I may be mispronouncing that. Last name S-A-R-K-I-S-I-A-N. The parliamentary speaker also assassinated was Karen Demircian, D-E-M-I-R-C-H-I-A-N. Now, what's of particular interest here is not only the fact that these assassinations took place right after some ostensibly promising negotiations with the U.S. State Department in an attempt to settle the dispute with Azerbaijan, but the group to which the assassins apparently belonged is of more than passing interest under the circumstances. Returning to the San Jose Mercury News story of Thursday, October 28th of 1999, we read, Rubin said the assassins appear to be a splinter group of the Dashnak Party, an Armenian nationalist party, 31 of whose members were jailed in 1995 for plotting a coup. Dashnag is spelled here, capital D-A-S-H-N-A-K. You'll see it spelled various ways, D-A-S-H-N-A-G or T-A-S-H-N-A-G. It is an English spelling of a word that is in a foreign language. And this is a group that has very significant implications for Armenian history and very bloody implications. For the Dashnags were a fascist or an ultra-nationalist group that actively collaborated with many of the nationalist groups that from the former Soviet Union that collaborated first with various Western nations' intelligence services, ultimately collaborated with Nazi Germany, and finally jumped to elements of Western intelligence along with the residua of the Reinhard Gehlen Nazi Eastern Front spy outfit about which we've spoken so often. And one of the major elements in that milieu, of course, is the anti-Bolshevik Bloc of Nations and the former World Anti-Communist League about which we've spoken so often in Radio Free America programs 14, 15, 36, and 37, among others. The Dashnags and their collaboration with Axis forces prior to and during World War II, we're going to read from a couple of sources. First of all, a book called American Swastika, authored by Charles Higham, last name H-I-G-H-A-M. American Swastika by Charles Higham was published in hardcover by Doubleday and Company, Garden City, New York, and copyright 1985. And of the Dashnags, their collaboration with the Third Reich, and also their collaboration with other former Soviet ethnic nationalities, we read, other organizations supported the Ukrainian fascists. These included Romanian groups connected to the Iron Guard. Support also came from the Armenians in the form of the Tashnags, or Armenian Revolutionary Federationers, who had made a deal with Hitler that he would put them in power when he invaded their Soviet-controlled territory. A Tashnag had stabbed to death Archbishop Leon Turian, capital T-O-R-I-A-N, primate of the Armenian Church in America when he was celebrating Mass in New York on Christmas Eve, 1933, charging that the Archbishop was a Soviet secret agent. The Tashnags had financial and personal links to the Irish and White Russian groups. As early as March 15, 1938, the ODWU, that's a Ukrainian fascist publication, beginning again as early as March 15, 1938, the ODWU organ, the Nationalist, extended an invitation to all Armenian revolutionaries to coordinate their activities with the Ukrainians, and that collaboration continued until the early 1940s. Like the Ukrainians, the Armenian terrorists falsely claimed the support of the whole of their national community. That again from American Swastika by Charles Higham of pre-World War II and World War II collaboration between the Dashnags, other dissident Soviet ethnic nationalities, and the Third Reich. Assassination is, as indicated in that passage, by no means a stranger to the Dashnag milieu, and a more detailed account of the assassination of Archbishop Turian is carried in a very well-known book from the World War II period called Undercover, subtitled My 4 Years in the Nazi Underworld of America, The Amazing Revelation of How Axis Agents and Our Enemies Within Are Now Plotting to Destroy the United States. This book is the most famous of several titles authored by a very prolific and brave anti-fascist researcher named John Roy Carlson, last name C-A-R-L-S-O-N. That's the nom de plume of an Armenian-American named Arthur Derunian, last name capital D-E-R-O-U-N-I-A-N. And John Roy Carlson's Undercover was published in hardcover in 1943 by E.P. Dutton and Company. And the book begins with a graphic account of the assassination of Archbishop Turian on, again, Christmas Eve 1933 by the Dashnags. Turning to Undercover, we read, Bound for the altar, the procession was led by a censer bearer followed by 12 members of the choir abreast in couples. Then came the resplendent figure of the primate. Two acolytes brought up the rear of the processional. Organ music filled the air, and a choir chanted softly as it started from the aisle. The devout crossed themselves. The candlelights flickered. Suddenly, from the right side of the aisle, a swarthy, pockmarked figure jumped into the aisle and stooped low. In his right hand was a two-edged butcher knife 6 inches long and whetted to razor sharpness. Simultaneously, from an adjoining pew, a second assailant threw himself on the primate and pinned back his arms, while the first one, with a pumping motion, stabbed 4 times through the sacred robes at the archbishop's vital section. Carried out with thoroughly practiced savagery committed in the presence of a stupefied crowd, the murder was over in a few seconds. The figure of the prelate lurched forward, then fell prostrate the full length of the aisle. The screaming, bewildered congregation stampeded to the door. Thomas E. Dewey, now governor of New York, was engaged to prepare the case against the assassins. 9 men were eventually convicted of the murder. All were found to be members and officers of the Armenian Revolutionary Federation, a secretive political gang also known as the Dashnag, whose methods anticipated those of the Gestapo. I had, of course, known of the existence of the Dashnag and had heard of their international program of terrorism, but the murder of Archbishop Turian and what became known of their organization during the trial brought to light the formidable power which this small but sinister fascistic clique wielded not only in America, but wherever Armenians lived. It was thoroughly hated by the overwhelming majority of Armenians, but they could do little about it. Later on in Undercover, John Roy Carlson discusses the collaboration between some Dashnag elements and the Christian mobilizers of Gerald L. K. Smith. Gerald L. K. Smith was a seminal American fascist whose efforts ultimately gave way to those of his proteges Wesley Swift, William Potter Gale, and Richard Gert Butler. Butler, of course, is now the head of the Aryan Nations compound in Idaho, and the heritage of the Dashnags as part of a fascist coalition embracing the forebears of the Aryan Nations is worth noting and under the circumstances here. Turning once again to Undercover by John Roy Carlson, we read of the collaboration between Dashnags and some of Gerald L. K. Smith's fascists. We read, "Much to my disgust, while with the mobilizers, I met 2 Dashnags, both of whom took prominent part in mobilizer affairs. These 2 Dashnags were the only Armenians I met in the subversive world in my 4 years as investigator. One was a real estate agent named Richard Koulian, spelled K-O-O-L-I-A-N, the other a youth who used the alias of Edward C. Adrian, capital A-D-R-I-A-N, but whose real name was Edward Mazgalajian, M-A-S-G-A-L-A-J-I-A-N. He contributed under both names to the Dashnag organ Haranek Weekly. My role as a synthetic Italian was so effective that they never suspected my identity. Adrian told me of the youth division of the Dashnag, known as Chegaron, coined from the Armenian words Cheg, T-Z-E-G-H, and Gron, G-R-O-N. Race, by the way, Cheg, by the way, means race, and Gron, religion. Continuing. The program and philosophy of these fascistic, race-worshipping nationalists were similar to the Hitler Youth, Adrian told me proudly."
That again from For the Record 182. The source is a Mercury News article, October 28, 1999, the book American Swastika by Charles Higham, and the book Undercover by John Roy Carlson, Like Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile, available for download for free on the SpitfireList.com website. There is a lot of information in the description for the program that we did not have time to fit into the broadcast itself. Please use that at SpitfireList.com. This concludes Side 2 of For the Record 811, Walking the Snake in Ukraine, Part 4, being recorded on September 21st of the year 2014. I'm Dave Emery. Ciao.